We're going to spend a little time talking about Sri Krishna Chaitanya. Chaitanya is credited with having inaugurated the kirtan movement, the chanting that's become so popular over the past 20, 30 years. Had its principal origins, not its exclusive origins, but a large part of its origins in Chaitanya, who appeared in Bengal. He was a native to Bengal, who was appeared there. When you speak of divine personalities, you don't always say that they were born, you say they appear as part of the tradition. So Chaitanya appeared in Bengal in 1486. And left this world in 1533. So it wasn't a very long life, about 48 years. But during that time, he initiated a renaissance of devotion to Krishna that has since traveled around the world. So the next time you chant mantras or have a kirtan, you might just think about Chaitanya and thank him for having inaugurated the chanting, the public chanting process. I wanted to explain why this detour into Chaitanya. Well, first of all, it has been the focus of the month, I think, until just recently. It was the January. It will be. I see, okay. We're ahead of the curve. So it will be the focus of the month. That's one reason. Another reason is that in the Bhagavad Gita, there is a verse where Krishna describes the life of his devotee as one who is constantly, a life that is constantly dedicated to chanting. The Sanskrit is kirtayantas chamam nityam tushyanti cha ramanti cha. Tasyantita ramantita means always joyful. Through the chanting, the life of devotion is a joyful life. So, that's another reason for discussing the life and teachings of Chaitanya, is that it is very apropos our exploration of the Bhagavad Gita. And the other reason is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu surfaced a dimension of devotion to Krishna that had never been emphasized before. In the history of yoga culture, there had never been anyone who had given Radha the prominence that she received from Chaitanya. So the emergence of the goddess, particularly Radha, as the ultimate expression of devotion to Krishna, that was a unique and exclusive gift that Chaitanya brought to the world. There was devotion to Krishna in previous centuries in the teachings of other acharyas, Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, Nimbarka, Vishnu Swami, others who had described Krishna as the Supreme Person. No one had given emphasis to Madhurya Rasa, this particular understanding of giving oneself in utter ecstatic rapture to the Supreme Person. That was a unique gift from Chaitanya. So we're going to look at the life of this great exemplar of devotion. Before we do, this is a chant to Chaitanya. We're going to learn a little bit about the people who populated Chaitanya's life and the people whom he brought close to him to share in this mission of bringing the chanting to the world. And you see them here. I'll describe them for you in a moment. This is the Chaitanya mantra, if you will. It's very simple. Prabhu Nityananda. Chaitanya and the people you see around him, sometimes called his associates. Sri Krishna Chaitanya is in the middle. Next to him, to his left, is Nityananda. Advaita is the older gentleman with a long white beard. Gadadhar, whom you see over here with the red robes, kind of in a half swoon there. And Srivas playing mridanga on the other end. These five are known as the Pancha Tattva, the five truths of Chaitanya.
How do you pronounce
the names? Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda. Prabhu is an honorific title that's given by people in the world of bhakti. You are my Prabhus. I will call you all Prabhu, which means master. You are all my master. So Prabhu. So we say Prabhu Nityananda. Sri is another honorific title meaning great or exalted. Sri Advaita. The V is like a W. So Advaita. Sri Advaita. Gadadhar. The final A is silent. Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktivrinda. Gaura Bhaktivrinda means and the other associates. So when we offer homage or appreciation to the great souls who have inaugurated the Kirtan movement, we honor first Chaitanya and his immediate associates, and then Gaura Bhaktivrinda, all of the other associates who may not be mentioned by name here. Right? So we can, why don't we just try pronouncing this together. Sri Krishna Chaitanya. Repeat that with me. Sri Krishna Chaitanya. Prabhu Nityananda. Prabhu Nityananda. Sri Advaita Gadadhar. Sri Advaita Gadadhar. Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktivrinda. Gaura Bhaktivrinda. Marvelous. Now this is sung. Chant once and then you chant.
Oh.
Chaitanya's life was marked by the constant chanting of this mantra. He chanted other mantras as well. There was one in particular that he taught all of his followers. That was a favorite. We've sung that before, haven't we? Just different names of Krishna. And as we will see, even as a young man, when he was with his friends, he was teaching them to chant. He was always chant, 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 chant. Everything about Chaitanya's life was about the chanting of the holy names of Krishna. The life of Chaitanya is recounted in two primary texts. The Chaitanya Charitamrita by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. Krishnadas Kaviraj was born in 1496, so he was a contemporary of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And the Chaitanya Bhagavat of Vrindavan Das Thakur. Vrindavan Das was born in 1507, so he wrote just shortly after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had left the world. Mahaprabhu himself, sometimes you'll hear me refer to him as Mahaprabhu. In India, you don't hear Chaitanya called Chaitanya very often. He'll more often be called Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu, we said that Prabhu means master. Mahaprabhu, that refers to Chaitanya, who is the great master. So, Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu Chaitanya was a profound philosopher, but he wrote no books. Next week, I'm going to hand out to you the only written text that was left by Chaitanya. It's called Shikshastika, and they are prayers that Chaitanya left that describe the intimate mood of someone who is immersed in the bhava, or the ecstasy of chanting the names of Krishna. And it's quite extraordinary. The teacher Bhaktivinod Thakur in the 19th century did an analysis of these eight prayers by Chaitanya and equated each of the eight prayers to one of the parts of the Krishna mantra. So the first Hare Krishna refers to the first verse in the Shikshastika, which is a glorification of the chanting. The second, Hare Krishna, refers to the exalting of the names as embodiment of the powers of the Supreme Divinity in sound form. And each of the verses in that way, going deeper and deeper. There's a point in the Shikshastika prayers where Chaitanya describes how he has no attraction. He says, I'm so unfortunate, I have no love for these names, these divine names. You've invested yourself, my dear Lord, in your name, but I have utterly no attraction for them. And he yearns, when will that day come when I will have such love for your holy names? And it goes deeper and deeper and deeper until by the time you've come to the end of these eight prayers, it is utterly ecstatic, where he's saying, you can do to me whatever you want. Whatever you want, I don't care. Just please don't kick me away. Don't kick me away. Let me serve you. And so it's this deepening of this thickening of this mood of ecstatic love for Krishna. And in the chanting, it's possible with some practice to chant Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, in such a way that each syllable of that mantra brings you deeper and deeper and deeper inside that mood that Chaitanya exhibited of utter surrender of the self to Krishna, to the divine. It was a short stay. His life in this world lasted only 48 years. And the last few years of his life were in seclusion in Jagannath Puri. So even those years should be removed. And if you think of it, it was really quite a short period of time. And yet what he did in that short period of time has had reverberations down through the centuries until now, the chanting, the kirtan movement is worldwide. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's message was really quite simple. It was, live a life of devotion, and that will be good for you and everyone you meet. Very simple message. And in this painting of Chaitanya, what you see is the artist has indicated Chaitanya in a line of avatars. You see Krishna just behind him. Before Krishna, you see Rama. Before Rama, you see Vishnu. And the artist's intention in this particular painting was to indicate that Chaitanya is an authorized avatar. I think we talked a little about this previously. No one can just claim to be an incarnation of God. You have to show chapter and verse. Let me see your papers. And in the revealed texts, there are descriptions of the, if you will, authorized incarnations. The appearance of Buddha is described in great detail in the Puranas and the histories. And they preceded Buddha's appearance by thousands of years. And similarly, Chaitanya. Specifically, I know we talked about this verse, in the 11th canto of the Bhagavat Purana, there is a verse that says, Krishna Varnam Tvise Akrishnam Sangupangartha Parshadam. That in the age of Kali, Yagyai Sankirtanai Prayar, Krishna will come, the divinity will come, in a form that is not of the Varna of Krishna, that is to say, not of that same color. Krishna was a dark bluish color, Chaitanya was golden. He's known as Gauranga, another name for Chaitanya. Gauranga refers to two things, one that he comes from the province of Godadesh in Bengal, and the other that he was of a Gora or golden complexion. So another name you'll hear often is Gauranga. So another quality that differentiated Chaitanya's appearance as an incarnation of the divine is that he carried no weapons. You see Vishnu in the back with his chakra, yeah, and his mace. You see Rama with his bow and arrows. Krishna also didn't have any weapons other than his beauty, which was devastating. But he did carry a flute. Chaitanya's arms were always up in the air like this. No weapons, nothing to fear, total surrender. And so that's described in this verse. Yagya Sankirtanai Prayar. His only weapon was the holy name. The chanting of the names of God disarmed, if you will, everyone he met. So the message was simple. All souls exist in order to engage in loving exchange with the divine. The Bengali, because Chaitanya was from Bengal and the language of the biographies is Bengal, is Jiver Sarup Hoy Nitir Krishna Das. Bengali saying here that Chaitanya, all beings are by nature part and parcel of Krishna. All living beings are part and parcel of Krishna. We'll talk a little bit about the environment that Krishna, that Chaitanya came into, which was quite antithetical to that message. Not everyone had the right to engage in devotion. And Chaitanya came to disarm that perverted social convention that only those born in the Brahminical class had the right to perform the ceremonies and chant the mantras and so on. He was mesmerizing. The texts describe that Chaitanya stood something like 7 feet tall. His arms were extraordinarily long, down past his knees. And until the time that he became a sannyasi or renunciant, he had long dark hair, very, very long hair. And his eyes were quite large and tapered like the petals of a lotus leaf. So if you can imagine such a personality dancing often with a garland of flowers swinging from his neck and these beautiful robes. I mean, you can imagine just that vision of such a character. It's described that people would break out into ecstasy, ecstatic love of Krishna, just seeing him in his chanting, coming down the street. He was very austere in his personal habits, but his life was one of great ecstasy. So those are not contradictory. You can be austere, but also exhibit signs of ecstasy. In fact, one of the great contributions of Chaitanya's mission was to show that emotion is not antithetical to scholarship. The tendency is to divorce these things. That if you are academically situated, if your knowledge is grounded, then there's going to be a certain kind of dispassionate approach to your subject. That's reflected in universities today, where only recently has there been an opening for scholar practitioners. It was very hard, for example, for somebody like me up until just recently to be able to teach on the university level. The suspicion was, well, how is he going to be objective? You know, how will he avoid that conversional tendency of someone who's practicing their faith? Right? That's also the problem of teaching the Bible. If you are a believing Christian, the suspicion that you have to overcome is that you're going to try to convert your students to Christianity. So there's a sense that these things are separate. Either you're a scholar, either you are philosophical and grounded in knowledge, or you're emotional. And the life of Chaitanya was fraught by this kind of bias against this extreme emotion that he'd be exhibiting. People would say, he's just a sentimentalist. He can't possibly actually be following the teachings of the scriptures, because how can anyone so emotional really be grounded in knowledge? That's answered in the Bhagavad Gita. It's in the 7th chapter. Does anyone have the Gita here? Cher, would you mind finding 7th chapter, verse 19 for us? I don't have a page for you. But if you would read the 19th verse of chapter 7, please. Here's the Sanskrit while she's looking it up. Bahunam janmanam ante gyanavam mam prapadyate vasudeva sarvamiti samahatma sudurlava. Translation?
After many births and deaths, he who is actually in knowledge surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very great.
Yeah. Real gyan, real knowledge, is Vasudeva Sarvamiti. That when you come to the conclusion of the academic study of texts, you find Krishna there. You find divinity there. You find love there. Scriptures are not synonymous with truth. They are an indication of where truth can be found. Knowledge itself is different from truth. Knowing that you are an eternal soul is not the same thing as realizing your eternity. Having the chapter and verse, the intellectual grasp of your spiritual nature, is not the same thing as fully realized, practiced wisdom. Those are two very different things. So in this verse of the Gita, we have an indication that study, if you've got that inclination, if you have some intellectual capacity, apply it here. Don't set that aside. There are two things. Your spiritual life is grounded on two parallel tracks. One is solid knowledge, which means you have to study, you have to learn the philosophy. And the other is practice. You can't just have knowledge without practice, because then it will become dry, theoretical. You have to enact what you've been studying, that's the practice. But if all you do is practice, and you never study what the knowledge is behind that practice, that can become sentimental. And you can go away from your practice. As soon as it becomes inconvenient, or you find something else that you'd prefer to do. So knowledge without practice becomes dry speculation. and practice without knowledge becomes sentimental, and then the extreme fanaticism. So to avoid that kind of misuse, both things have to be there. So that was Chaitanya's life, a balance between scholarship and practice. The ecstasy that Chaitanya was experiencing in his later years is called in Sanskrit Vipralamba. Vipralamba means the excruciating pain of being separated from the person you love. I will never forget getting on a plane. It was October 28th, 1982. When I say I'll never forget, I mean I will never forget. October 28th, 1982, it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I left France to come back to live in America. And my son was staying in France. That separation is a pain that to this day I feel it. Like a knife wound in me. That pain of separation. It is excruciating. On the spiritual platform, it is ecstatic beyond imagining. It is painful, but it is painful in a way that we can't understand. If you read the description of the life of these spiritual personalities and the life of the Goswamis, Chaitanya's associates, and the life of Chaitanya itself, you can say, how do they bear to live? They were in such pain all the time. Like, oh my God, where is Krishna? I can't bear to live. It's like, I want to die. It's like, how can they go on like that? And actually, they couldn't. There are descriptions of fainting and going into swoons and unable to bear that pain of separation from Krishna. There are descriptions of the gopis, the cowherd women, when Krishna would be absent from them, they would go first into a deep samadhi, sadhikalpa samadhi, where they would begin to meditate on him within their hearts. And they would leave their body, they would die to this life, so that they're in their spiritual form, they could run to Krishna and be with him in their spiritual form. So they would die, this physical form would die, and they would go on that spiritual platform, their souls would be with Krishna. Chaitanya lived that constant feeling of separation. And not today, because today we'll be talking about his early life, but next week and the week after, we'll be reading some of the descriptions of how painful it became that he would shed blood and his body, he would swoon and his body would elongate, the limbs would come detached from his frame and he would be stretched out longer than humanly possible. Just symptoms of ecstasy that are not possible for us. This is called Mahabhava. This is a very, very elevated place that we will not know. But in our own way, we can experience, to our own degree, some separation from Krishna. So his mission was threefold. Spread the chanting of the holy names, kirtan. Spread the kirtan movement. Oh, that's a very good question. Yes, there was reunion. There was yoga. There was that uniting with Krishna. And the coming together was ecstatic. And the going away was ecstatic. And it's described like waves of the ocean, bringing things together and then separating them and then bringing them together. There's this roiling, churning ocean of ecstatic love that would sometimes bring them together and sometimes separate them apart, and it was just going on and on and on. So yes, it's a good question. Sometimes there would be coming together and then they would be separated again, and the separation was considered even more ecstatic than the coming together. So the kirtan movement was his first mission. Through that chanting, the second part of his mission, to awaken love for Krishna and everyone, and particularly with that view toward the ecstatic love of Radha for Krishna, that sense of God as our ultimate lover, not God as father or provider, but that sense of the divine, the source of everything, as being such a place of ecstasy for the soul that it breaks all social conventions. I think we've talked about this there, the progressive stages of ecstasy that begin with a passive awareness. For those of you who may not have been here for that, we become aware of Krishna first in a kind of passive mode. Oh yeah, Krishna. Yes, there's a greater mystery out there. Krishna is out there. You don't do anything with that. That's a kind of passive place. It's called Shanta Rasa. Shanti, Om Shanti. Place of peace, place of calm, because you're aware that there is a greater mystery than all of this crazy stuff that goes on in your life. But you're not doing much with that yet. When it becomes more intense, it becomes a mood of servitude. Now I wish to serve that great being. There is some greater force. I want to do something practical with that awareness. That formality, however, when it breaks down and it's no longer master and servant, but equals, that becomes a relationship of friendship. So that friendship is when you are always with Krishna under all circumstances as your best friend. Friendship is casual. So when the love becomes even more intense and that casual quality gives way to a feeling that I must serve Krishna, because if I don't, he's going to get into trouble. He's a little boy, and if I don't serve him, he's going to fall in the river. Or if I don't feed him, he's going to go hungry. There's some sense of parental affection. So beyond the sense of friendship is parental affection. Parental affection, however, still follows certain social protocols. When those protocols fall away, and what you're feeling in your heart is unrestrained, unqualified, I don't give a damn what anybody thinks, love for Krishna. That Krishna is my beloved. I am his, he is mine. That sense of ownership, of possession. Krishna is mine. He is my lover. I give myself to him completely without any holding back, without any reservation. He can do whatever he wants. That madhurya rasa, that is a conjugal mood where you and God become lovers, and there's that intimacy that can only take place between two people who are in that most intimate relationship. That was the mood of Chaitanya. Chaitanya worshipped that devotion that was embodied in Radha's love for Krishna. And then, the third, or the most esoteric part of Chaitanya's mission, was to experience that love himself. It's the one thing that God cannot know. Is why do my devotees love me so much, and what does that feel like? The only way to know that is to become that. So for Krishna to understand the depth of Radha's love for him, he had to leave aside his position as Krishna and appear as a devotee of Krishna in that mood of Radha. That's Chaitanya. So you have the exoteric mission or the external purpose for Chaitanya's appearing in the world. And then you have this esoteric or internal mission, which was to experience himself, that ecstasy of madhurya rasa, of Radha's love for Krishna. Okay, how are we doing so far? Is that alright? Alright, I want to get into the stories of Chaitanya's life, but I'm going to check in with you and just make sure that we're on the same track here. Any questions about any of this so far? Yeah.
About going back to knowledge and practice.
Yes.
I read in the Gita that, I don't remember how it was aligned, but it was like, you only need like a little bit of knowledge and
Yeah, well, the question is, the comment, and it's an important one, is that you don't have to be accumulating all the knowledge that there is. One truth is sufficient, right? Is that the point? That if you have just enough knowledge that you can then begin your service to others, that is sufficient knowledge. Am I understanding you correctly? Yeah, it's an interesting observation, and I agree with you. You know, you don't want to just be stuffing your head all the time with more facts and more data. If you've caught fire and you have that inspiration to go out and serve, go and follow that impulse. I've discovered for myself, and it's there's some indications also in the text, and Gita also, that from a place of devotion, knowledge has a different quality to it. It's like if you love someone, you never tire of hearing about that person, of learning more about that person, of discovering different dimensions. That sense of enthusiasm for knowledge as an adjunct of devotion, knowledge as a support to devotion, as opposed to what I think you're referring to, which is a more kind of academic, scholarly study of knowledge. Would that be correct? Yeah. Yeah. There's a different quality to knowledge that enhances our understanding of devotion. There's never too much of that. You can never get enough of that. The taste for that grows and grows and grows. And it's a lovely thing. That's what constitutes the substance of Sangha. When people come together for Sangha, it's not just chanting, it's not just the yoga practices, but it's also good talks. And if you've read something in the Gita or in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, bring that and you share that with others, and there's an exchange of those ecstatic, deepening understanding of devotion and service. So that, I remember Prabhupada describing it to me one time as being like an ocean. You start swimming and you never find any end to it. You just keep going, going. It's growing more and more all the time. That's a different quality, I think, of knowledge. Yeah?
On Shastra, scripture study, one of the five tenets of devotion.
We can never come to the end of knowledge. I mean, it's infinite. So some effort to continue learning is a good idea. But I understand your point. You know, if it just becomes accumulating facts, what good is that?
I was going to say that there's a thing saying by Sri Prabhupada Joyce, the great one who said yoga is 99% practice and 1% knowledge or something like that. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Something like that, 99% practice and 1% knowledge. And so I think his point was to say that not that knowledge is not important, it's not important, but that knowledge is exciting when you can put it into practice.
Mm. And 1% of infinity is still infinity. It just grows and grows. Good. There was another, Michael?
It just reminded me of the focus of the month of Abhyasa, Vyagyam, Niroda, the practice of non-attachment, the double-edged sword that you can practice, you have to have non-attachment in your practice, but how do you practice without non-attachment? It's kind of like how you engage.
that's through his practice he got to know how everything is just by studying within.
Yeah. And if you look at these great yogis and great souls, most of them are teaching knowledge. So they don't neglect knowledge. I think the point is that you can. There's a kind of ego that can come with knowing too much. And you want to avoid that. I don't know about you, but along the course of time, I've met people who are very knowledgeable, and they really knew it. That's an interesting observation. How do you teach devotion?
Uh-huh.
Right. You inspire devotion, I guess. Yeah. Okay. Good. Right. All very nice comments. Very good. Let's learn something about the life of Chaitanya, shall we? These are deities of Chaitanya and his principal associates, the Pancha Tattva, or the five forms of Chaitanya, that you'll see in the Vaishnava temples. Chaitanya was came into an environment in 15th century Bengal that was alive with philosophical debate. Navadvip was kind of the Oxford of India, if you will. And the conversations were rich with study of the texts. And the conversations were complicated by the fact that at this period in time, India was ruled by the Mughals, starting in the 16th century. India was a occupied nation. And the Islamic view of devotional culture was quite harsh and quite critical. The deities were frowned upon, and were the word iconoclast initially refers to someone who would destroy icons. And that was a practice during this period. The temple domes were literally brought down, and deities were smashed. And so the devotional element of Indian yoga culture went underground. During the Mughal period, it was suppressed. Then later, starting in about the 17th century, the British condemned it as heathen. The Sahajiya, or the, if you will, the schism groups, distorted it by using the pretext of that Madhurya relationship between Krishna and Radha as an excuse for sexual rituals. And then the intellectuals in the 18th and 19th centuries attempting to reform Indian culture betrayed that devotional content by setting it aside, by condemning it as a vestige of a less developed time in India's history. You don't have to put us down, they said, to Enlightenment intellectual Europe, because this worship of Krishna is really just the earlier stages. Those are for people who don't have enough knowledge, if you will. They're not elevated enough to understand the real meaning of Vedanta. So that doesn't really represent us. So the tradition of bhakti, or worship of a supreme being, was having a very, very problematic history. And it was into this condition that Chaitanya appeared. He came at the behest of Advaita. Now, Advaita was 52 years senior to Chaitanya. And he looked at this condition of the world around him and said, only God himself can rectify this. So he prayed to the Shalagram Shila, this representation of the divinity in the form of a stone, offering tulsi leaves, leaves of the sacred tulsi plant, and saying, please come into this world. Please do something. It's gone too far. Only you can do something to change this. And when Chaitanya appeared, it was on a full moon night. There was an eclipse of the full moon. And in Indian culture, an eclipse of the moon is considered inauspicious, and the way to countermand that inauspicious occasion is by immersing yourself in a sacred river such as the Ganges and chanting the names of the divine. So when Chaitanya appeared, his mission was foretold because all of India was chanting the names of Krishna just at that moment. And when he came home, it was to this place under this tree, and you can still visit this tree. It's about 2 hours north of Calcutta in the town of Mayapur. And it was in this little house that Chaitanya appeared. This is the birthplace of Chaitanya here. It's known as the Yoga Pitha, or the place of an appearance of a divine personality. And when Chaitanya was still just a child, the neighbors would come to his home, and his mother, whose name was Sachi Devi, would receive them, and his father would be there, and the neighbors would come in, and they would say, I'll say, this child reminds me of Krishna. So you see that remembrance of Krishna there in this particular painting. And then something unusual happened. Whenever the child, Chaitanya, would cry, if the neighbors would begin chanting Hare Krishna, he would stop crying. And as soon as they stopped chanting, he would start crying again. And as soon as they started chanting, he would stop crying. And in this way, they began to realize that, oh, he wants us to chant. And there was this sense, even from very, very early childhood, of this mission of getting people to chant the names of Krishna. Here you see him with his mother and father. And there were some stories from Chaitanya's childhood. Here he is teaching the other little children of his village to chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. There, of course, are stories from Chaitanya's early life that kind of tend to point toward the divinity of this young child. There's one story that a snake came and wrapped itself around him. And when Mother Sachi came and saw that, she was terrified for her child's life. And the snake, seeing that his mother was, Chaitanya's mother was afraid, unwrapped and went discreetly off and left him alone. But sort of like Vishnu lying on the serpent bed. That's one such story. Another such story was that one day a Brahmin came through Bengal, and around his neck he carried a small deity of Bala Krishna, child Krishna. And he would offer whatever food he would eat, he would first take the deity off of this lanyard on his neck, and that became the altar, and he would offer his food. Jagannath Mishra, Chaitanya's father. Chaitanya at this time in his life was known as Nimai, because he was born under that neem tree. So he was known as Nimai. So Nimai's father, Jagannath Mishra, met this Brahmin and said, well, come to my house and you can cook for your deity in my home. I'll give you everything you need. I'll bring the vegetables and please be my guest. So the Brahmin came home and was reciting prayers, cooked the food, put it on the altar, calling Krishna to eat. Here, along comes little baby Nimai as the Brahmin is with his eyes closed meditating and helps himself to the food on the altar. And the Brahmin opens his eyes and says, no, stop, stop, what are you doing? That's for Krishna, that's for my deity of Krishna. Why are you doing this? And what's going on? They came running and they saw that the child had eaten the food that had been offered on the altar to the deity. And Jagannath Mishra was so embarrassed, he was mortified, saying, oh, please, let me bring you more food that you can cook. Let me bring you more materials that you can cook again for your deity. Please, I won't be happy until you do it. Well, okay, fine. So the Brahmin again prepares the food, brings it to the altar, closes his eyes, goes into deep meditation, and then again the child comes and there's Nimai on the altar eating the foods. The Brahmin is screaming now. What's going on here? Clearly Krishna does not want me to eat today. He wants me to fast. So I will fast. And Jagannath Mishra, this time it's late at night, he's saying, no, look, I don't know what to say, except that I will lock this child in his room I will stay with him. It's time for us to all go to sleep. Anyway, you have the house to yourself. Please cook once more. Well, the pilgrim does. He prepares the food, puts it on the altar. And somehow or other, this little child manages to get out of a locked room where he's guarded. And when the Brahmin opens his eyes, there is little Nimai, who now manifests himself to the Brahmin as Krishna, shows the Brahmin his form. And he says, you keep calling me to eat, that's why I'm eating it. He says, now I'm showing you my true form, because for many, many lives you have been my great devotee. And now you are with me again here. But please just keep it a secret. Don't tell anybody what this is, because I've come for a different purpose. So some of these stories are described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. And then Nimai's confidence as he got older grew, and he became a very good student. But he wouldn't listen to anybody. He wouldn't listen to his teachers. He wouldn't listen to his parents. He was rather mischievous as a young man. He had an older brother named Vishwarup. And Vishwarup one day heard his parents talking about wanting to get him married. And Vishwarup had no interest in family life. He wanted to become a sannyasi, and did so. He left and left for South India and spent the remainder of his life on pilgrimage. Little Nimai, young Chaitanya, had a dream that, in this dream, his brother Vishwarup said to him, come with me. Come with me, leave home and become a traveling monk like me. And when Nimai awoke from this dream, he realized that he couldn't do that, that his mother and father depended too much on him. And he told his mother and father, I will take care of you. You do not have to worry. I will never leave you. Shortly after, however, his father, Jagannath Mishra, passed away. And by the time Chaitanya was 16 years old, he was now the head of this household without a father. And a young man in his position needed to have a wife. So there was a young woman whom he used to meet on his way home from school. Her name was Lakshmi Devi. She was the daughter of a local Brahmin, and they were married. So here you see Chaitanya with his wife Lakshmi Devi on the occasion of their wedding. Chaitanya continued his studies and continued to teach, and he was a quite well-known teacher. He was a profound teacher, and he became very well known for his erudition. Well, around this time, there was a renowned scholar named Digvijaya Pandit, who was kind of proud of his scholarship. In fact, he would show up at a place with a whole entourage, and they'd be riding on elephants, and they'd have bullock carts full of all of his scriptures and knowledge, and, you know, was just coming out of every pore of his body. And Chaitanya told his students, he said, this is not a bad man, but he needs to be humbled a little bit. So let's see what we can do. So he went and he said to Digvijaya Pandit, I would like to invite you to come and give us a demonstration of your wisdom, of your knowledge. Digvijaya Pandit, who was, you know, the great scholar, said, well, I'd be happy to do that. So the people assembled and Digvijaya Pandit came. Chaitanya said, please, speak something on Mother Ganges. So for a full hour, Digvijaya Pandit recited spontaneous verses in praise of the Ganges River. And after an hour of this, it was 3 hours, it wasn't 1 hour, it was 3 hours of spontaneous poetry in praise of the Ganges River. And at the end of this 3 hours, he's looking at Chaitanya as though, what do you think of that? And Chaitanya says, you know, that was really quite spectacular. There's this one verse about 90 minutes in that you got wrong. And he went into a particular verse and described 5 faults in this one verse. In particular, one thing he mentioned was, in the verse Digvijaya Pandit was describing Shiva, He was glorifying Shiva. And he called him Bhavati Bhartu. Bhavati Bhartu technically translates as the husband of Shiva's wife. So the implication there is that she has another husband. So by that slight, if you will, grammatical mistake, there was an offense being committed. And he described five such faults in this one verse. And Digvijaya Pandit was stunned. He just couldn't believe what he was hearing. Anyhow, hundreds, thousands of verses. How is he remembering this one verse and able to analyze this with such precision? That night, Chaitanya saw that Digvijaya Pandit was embarrassed by this. And he said, well, you're tired. You're tired from all of your travels. Go home and rest. Tomorrow we'll meet again. That night, Digvijaya Pandit had a dream, and the goddess of learning, Saraswati, appeared to him and said, you're a fool. Don't you see who this is? This is the supreme person appearing as this young scholar. Go to him. Accept him as your teacher. Don't be so proud. And the next morning, Digvijaya Pandit did. And he came, he surrendered. This was the process, that if someone defeated you philosophically, if they were able to demonstrate a greater knowledge, you would become their disciple. You became their student. And that was a formal exchange. And so Digvijaya Pandit was humbled by this. He gave away all of his possessions and became a much more modest person after that. So that's one more story from Chaitanya's life. He decided to go on pilgrimage and bring teachings about Krishna to other parts of India. He was away for 2 months and his wife died of separation from him. Her love for him was so intense that she passed away. And Chaitanya came back and his mother said, I can't bear to see you like this. There's another girl in the village I would like you to meet. And so here you see the deity that was worshipped by Vishnu Priya, Chaitanya's second wife. Vishnu Priya was 19 years old when they were married. She lived to a ripe old age. She lived to be 90. And during her entire life, this particular deity, which you can still see if you go to Mayapur in India, is there. Chaitanya, this is the last slide, and then we're going to have some discussion here. Chaitanya wanted to go to Gaya to perform rituals for his deceased father. There's a certain, after a certain period of time in Hindu culture, you perform rites for a dead parent. And so Chaitanya went to Gaya to perform these services for his late father. And in Gaya was this a footprint of Vishnu that is described that Vishnu had left the imprint of his foot in this stone. And when Chaitanya saw that footprint of Vishnu, things changed. That encounter with something that close to the form of his beloved Lord Krishna transformed him. And while he was in Gaya, he took formal initiation and came back a changed person. From that time on, he was a changed person. And how he was changed, we'll get into next week. But it's at this point that he really began dedicating himself to the mission of bringing the chanting of the Krishna mantra to the world. Yes, tune in next week. Same time, same station. So there's a little bit of a glimpse at the early part of the life of Chaitanya, to whom we owe a great debt for having brought us the Kirtan movement. So, let me first ask you if you have any questions. Yeah?
When did you start chanting?
Well, the chanting was always there in the culture. But after he came back from this experience of seeing the footprint in Gaya, things changed. And his focus on devotion became much more pronounced. And he wasn't any longer the light-hearted young man he had been. He was a bit of a cut-up, you might say, as a boy. He would play tricks, the way child Krishna was mischievous and would play tricks. Chaitanya was also kind of mischievous as a boy, and he would, when the young women were swimming in the river, he'd steal their clothes, or when the Brahmins were doing whatever. He had some of that mischief in him. When he came back from Gaya, he was a changed person.
How old was he then?
At this point, he's in his late teens. He's still just a teenager. But he took this change quite seriously. And very soon, what we'll start off with next week is the gathering around him of a team of people who could help him with this mission of bringing, of resuscitating love for Krishna in the culture. And that took many different forms, including the Sankirtan, or the going out into the street with drums and the kartal brass cymbals to chant the names of Krishna. Yeah.
I read recently there was Swami was talking about the Kirtan movement and how it used to be much more grand in the and he was talking about how back like 10-15 years ago there would be like hundreds of people converging on like Times Square and the park, and it would be like this grand festival, and it just doesn't happen now. That the Kirtan movement isn't as popular as it used to be.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that that's necessarily true, but I remember myself at age 21 or 22 when I was living in the Krishna temple in Brooklyn. Every Friday night, I guess, and Saturday night, we would go out en masse, either to Times Square, 42nd Street, or to Central Park during the day, and it was huge. I mean, there would be hundreds of people and dozens of these mridanga drums going. It was amazing. I mean, it was, you could hear it a mile away. I mean, there was this sound that was like a tidal wave just coming down the street. Boom, da, boom, 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 da, boom. And, you know, people jumping up and down. I mean, the joint was just going crazy. And I remember that the thinking at that time was that this was, we're really carrying forth Chaitanya's mission. That was the mood then. I even recall that we would wear yellow cloth. The men would wear yellow dhotis and the women would wear yellow saris. And it would be blazing bright to see. There was the person in charge back then, whose name was Bhavananda, had been one of the Andy Warhol, Max's Kansas City crowd, and he had a flair for design. So he found this sheer synthetic material that was like day glow yellow. It was literally 3D in your face. You can't even look at it. It's so bright yellow. There was only one problem. It was so sheer that it wouldn't stay knotted. And we were always finding ourselves with our clothing down on the ground as we'd be out doing these Sankirtan chanting parties. We would be holding on with one hand in the air and the other hand holding on to our dhotis. And sorry, I remember that was a big embarrassment. But yeah, that was quite something.
Kirtan movement's moving more towards like the Rakshar Kirtan.
It's an interesting question. It is a concern. I will share that with you, that I am concerned that so much of Kirtan has become a performance art. And it's not quite the participation that it used to be.
Yeah, like, I notice a difference like on the Saturday once a month Bhakti Kirtans that like, we go to. I mean, there are loud, rambunctious, there's hundreds of people,
yeah.
And everybody's just screaming, yelling, and jumping around. And it's loud, it's fast, it's laughing. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed the other kirtans that are like more like performers, and they're much more
right.
Sit, and it's much more about, it's a different participation.
No, it's a good point. Now, in all fairness, in India, there are some very famous kirtaniyas, you know, kirtan leaders and chanters, who have exquisite voices and so much devotion, and they'll invest something magical into a kirtan. But usually, it's not something where, you know, they're up on the stage and you've paid your money and you're here for a performance. It's still participatory. The kirtans in India are not as scripted as they are here. I think here there's kind of a set pattern. And if you've heard so-and-so sing that particular bhajan before, that's how it will sound again next time. In India, there's a spontaneity to it that you don't know what's going to come up next. And sometimes the leader will be, you know, swirling in circles and then stop dead on and go into some other place, some story or some other recitation of a verse. And then boom, you're back into it, and that ecstatic kirtan is going on again. And it's the not knowing that's part of the energy of the kirtan. You don't know where it's going to go next.
Right.
And you're really caught up in it. It's something. It's something to see. Yeah, if you don't see as many of those big Sankirtan groups going out on the streets as once used to go, we grew up, got jobs,
mortgages,
families. They still take place, but it's not quite the youthful exuberance that was once there. So, and people also, the times have changed. You know, the culture around us has changed. You don't have as many people living in ashrams anymore. Someone said to me that they had just been recently to India to the what had been the Maharishi ashram where the Beatles went in 1968. Mm-hmm. Says it's abandoned now. You know, tigers live there. There isn't the same ashram culture. So you don't have quite as many people available to go out on these kirtan chantings as once were there. But it still happens. It's still there. Yeah.
I think that in the days of Chaitanya and Krishna, was it more effective to teach through kirtan to people versus through oral tradition or through actual written scriptures?
That's a good question.
It's like here, right? When we chant verses, sometimes we don't understand what they mean yet. But we chant them and we come and we feel them. And then so through feeling, you learn, you become, you go. Versus just sort of hearing them, or being told them without actually saying or feeling the vibration.
There were the kinds of gatherings that we know here also. And there would be discussion, you know, and the meaning of the chanting was talked about, you know. And there would be one kind of kirtan for children, simple. And there would be something perhaps somewhat more sophisticated for the adults. And then there were some kirtans that you couldn't get into. Some of the kirtans that Chaitanya had, for example, were very exclusive because the ecstasies were so intimate and so complete that if anyone was not understanding of it and part of that inner group, it would spoil the mood. In fact, there's even one story that Chaitanya, in the house of Srivas, one of those intimate people we're learning about who he had around him, in Srivas's home called Srivasanga, you can see that same house is still there. The more intimate kirtans would be going on. And one time somebody snuck in because he'd heard about these kirtans, and he went under a basket over the corner, just hiding there. And Chaitanya stopped. He said, I can't do this. Something's wrong. There's somebody here who's not supposed to be here. And they looked around. They found this fellow under the basket. So they asked him to please leave. And those ecstasies during those intimate kirtans were such that, how to say this, there were physical transformations that took place. So you have all kinds of kirtans that were going on. And yes, there were discussions, and that sangha was critically important. In fact, when Chaitanya would swoon, when he would go into his ecstasies, the only way to revive him was to recite verses from the texts. Then those intimate associates who understood what he was going through, they would recite verses. Oh, my dear Lord, where are you now? Verses of Radha's love for Krishna. And that would revive him, because he said, you understand my heart. You understand what I'm going through. And that would bring him back to consciousness. So that... Yeah. That's very advanced kirtan. We're not there yet. Yeah, that's a good point. You've just very accurately described the situation of Vyasa, who compiled the Vedas. He had all this knowledge. This really speaks to your point as well. He had compiled all the Vedic knowledge. He was completely dissatisfied. So his teacher, Narada, came to him and said, don't you understand why you're unhappy? He says, you forgot about love. You have all this knowledge that you've compiled. Now talk about Krishna. Now describe the soul's ecstasy for love of God. That was missing. So that's when he compiled the bhakti texts. Yeah?
Could you say something about how people say that kirtan is the most essential practice of our time, the most effective practice of our time? Could you say something about where that idea comes from?
Well, the description in the bhakti text is that this particular age of Kali, the Kali Yuga, is very problematic. It doesn't lend itself... We're not rewarded for deep thinking in this age. This is not a time when prolonged periods of meditation... And when I say prolonged, I don't mean an hour. I mean, you know, years. it's not very practical for most people. And something is needed that can streamline the process of feeling something that will encourage us to go forward. That's the chanting. Chanting is instantaneous. There's an immediate reward. There's immediate payback from the chanting. It triggers something. There's something about chanting that evokes something instantly inside us. And the more the chanting is done, especially with a view toward devotion, that taste is cultivated in previous era, in previous yugas, when circumstances were different. Prolonged meditation was one form. Elaborate deity worship in the previous yuga. By elaborate, I mean, you know, fire pits where tons of gold and spices and huge ceremonies that just can't, no one can afford to do that now. So those practices are no longer feasible. And in this age, the chanting is a special dispensation, if you will. It's simple. Even a child can chant. Anyone can chant and dance in ecstasy. You don't have to be a great scholar. And it's there in most faith cultures as well, to invoke the name of the divinity. It's not just in the bhakti culture, it's there in most cultures. Praise ye the name of the Lord with the high sounding cymbals. It's there in other cultures. So, a little something about Chaitanya. You want to try that mantra that Chaitanya liked to chant? Should we do that? Have we discussed enough about this? There's so much to it. I mean, I just...
Did they use any musical instruments too?
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy, did they use musical instruments. They had whompers. I mean, big brass... And they had shanais, and they had long horns, and all kinds of drums, especially mridanga drums. And I mean, it was tumultuous. When that kirtan party, next week we're going to talk about what happened when they staged a non-violent protest against the Muslim magistrate who had forbidden kirtan. The Muslim magistrate was in cahoots with the caste Brahmins, who were really angry at Chaitanya for having allowed everybody in to that devotional circle and therefore threatening the Brahminical power, the Brahminical authority. So the Muslim magistrate had forbidden kirtan. He sent his henchmen to break the drums. They broke the mridanga drums, which are made of clay and rather fragile. So Chaitanya staged the first non-violent, non-cooperation movement. It is sometimes described as the inspiration for Gandhi's movement against the British. And huge thousands of people with hundreds of drums and all these instruments. The sound was unbelievable. And the Qazi was terrified. He was utterly terrified. What are these people going to do to me? You know, this tidal wave coming down the street. He had no idea what was going to happen. Chaitanya said, no, it's fine. It's fine. Let's sit and talk. And he got them to change the rules. Lots of instruments. Yeah.
And were his parents also great devotees of Krishna, and they were chanting as well?
Sure. In fact, at one point, Chaitanya tells his mother, you can be comfortable with what's happening here. You don't always have to be so anxious for me. You have been my mother in many previous births. You were my mother when I appeared in my original form of Krishna. You were my mother when I appeared in this form. You were my mother when I appeared in that form. Now you are again my mother. This is going on. Pastime after pastime after pastime. So that's interesting, because what it says is that even great souls who are the mother of the divinity sometimes do not know their past lives. And that's one of the great philosophical questions. How human does the supreme being have to become in order to play the role of a human being in the world? It's one of the great mysteries that Chaitanya came in order to experience what it was like to be a lover of God as a human being would love God. How human did he become in order to fulfill that role? How human did Rama have to be in order to be the ideal king? And the discrepancies in his behavior emerge from that utterly incomprehensible dilemma of being simultaneously God and therefore fully cognizant, and yet simultaneously setting that aside in order to enact this pastime in the world. It's one of the great mysteries. Whenever anyone would say, Chaitanya, you are Krishna, he would cover his ears. I don't want to hear that. I am a devotee. I am trying to be a devotee. Gopi Bharatupata Kamaleo Dasa Dasa Dasanu Dasa. I wish to be a servant of the servant. Please don't. And yet, sometimes he would reveal himself as well. Okay, quick chant. And then I'll send you home. This is a chant that Chaitanya would have people sing. It is a great, great, great honor to be asked to come and say something to you about Chaitanya. Even more than attempting to be a devotee of Krishna, the bhakti tradition attempts to be a devotee of Chaitanya. Because it is through Chaitanya and the teachings that he gave us and the chanting that we can one day aspire to possibly attempt to try to approach the smallest little beginnings of devotion to Krishna. So please take this gift from Chaitanya home with you and always chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And I will hope to see you next week when we're going to dive a little bit deeper into the ocean of Chaitanya's ecstasies. Thank you. What have you brought this evening for us, O bearer of the prasadam? Feast. What's that? Cassava cake. Really? Really? Cassava cake and grapes. My goodness. Well, thank you very much. So far as our holiday schedule, I'm going to